Darren, how about telling me a little bit about yourself and your background? How long have you been with Capital Power in Genesee?
Quite a long time. I started in 1989, so I'm into my 27th year. My background is I'm a mining engineer. I graduated from the University of Alberta in 1983. I spent most of my time in the coal side of the business, but initially I was involved in gold and silver mining.
What attracted you to mining?
Just a big equipment, getting underground. I used to always like to build tunnels and stuff in the snow, and just being outdoors.
So when you look at what's happening with coal mining now and the changes and also changing public opinion about coal and the use of coal, what would be your comments on the changes?
Well, I believe there's a lot of misinterpretation out there in terms of the public's perception of coal. I believe a lot of it is coming out of the Industrial Revolution in England and coal being painted with a, I hate to say it, but kind of a black and dirty picture. The truth of the matter is that it's a valuable fuel that we use to produce generation and electricity in the province here. It's a fuel that does produce more CO2 per megawatt output than other types of fuels, but we're doing our best to mitigate that at Genesee by coming up with various ways of reducing other areas that produce greenhouse gases, like, for example, the use of fly ash in concrete. By using the fly ash that's produced at Genesee as a substitute for Portland cement and concrete, we can reduce the amount of greenhouse gas that's produced from the cement plant.
Well, following up on that then, recently the Alberta Auditor General issued a report looking at the State of the Union, I guess, in terms of coal and what's happening with it in the province. What exactly did he say?
I believe the Auditor General's general sort of feelings was that when it comes to reclamation of mine sites in Alberta, there's not enough funds being put away by the industry to cover the eventuality of a mine shutting down and then not being able to pay for the reclamation themselves, and then it basically being turned over to the government to have to fund the reclamation and clean up the mine. I think that was the gist of his comments in the journal.
From the industry side, from your perspective, how is Capital Power, how is Genesee doing on that front?
Yes, at Genesee, we've been aware of this issue for quite a number of years, going back to 1995, actually. And at that point in time, we did a very extensive study of what it would take to decommission and reclaim the Genesee mine. And we came up with what's called our annual reclamation obligation amount. And we've been continuing to revise that study every few years so that we are completely in tune with what it would cost us to decommission the mine and reclaim it if it were to shut down tomorrow. And so there's been a number of funds vis-a-vis a security deposit that's been placed with the provincial government that guarantees that there are funds available for the Genesee mine's eventual decommissioning and reclamation.
What is your annual reclamation obligation?
The last time I looked at it, we had approximately between $30 and $35 million sitting as security for the eventual reclamation of the mine.
So that's what you've put aside over time. That's not what you have to do every year.
Right. That's what we've put aside. So that would guarantee that these funds would be available if tomorrow the mine shut down. So those funds would then be used to do the reclamation. Now, is it enough? I'm not really sure.
So when you're doing your mine planning, what is the process that you use?
Well, we generally start with a very long-term view of where we believe the mine will go, and the mine generally tends to follow where the coal is. So we produce a, call it a 50-year plan, because we believe that's the life of our units. And then from that plan, we build a medium-term mine plan, which we call our 5-year plan, and that kind of shows the general direction we're going in the 5 years. And then from that 5-year plan, we extract our annual detailed plan, which is pretty darn close to where we think we're going to be during the course of the year. So that's the process.
Is that pretty standard in the industry to do a 50 years out?
Yes, I think each company will probably want to look at where they're going to go into the future, because there are some things that you need to start working on today to get you to that point in the future. By way of example is the fact that we've just completed a extension of our mine permit that will enable us to provide fuel to the Genesee units for their 50-year deemed lives. So that process took place and it was just completed recently, but it was looking at what's going to happen way down the road, because those kind of things take time. It took us about 5 to 6 years to complete the process, so we wanted to make sure it was done in advance of sort of getting out there.
So how easy is it, though, to adapt to change, like either changing regulations or changing scientific information? Certainly in the last few months, there's been a lot of concern now about how fast climate change is happening.
Yes.
How do you adapt and incorporate that into your 50-year plan?
Well, again, we're a coal-fired generating company, so maybe we're the worst guy on the block. I'm not going to speculate on that. So that means that we have to look at all sorts of different technologies all the time to try and improve our efficiency and reduce the amount of CO2 that we produce. So that is an ongoing process. We are looking at ways to perhaps blend a biomass product, which is CO2 neutral, into the coal feed, so reducing the amount of coal that we burn. Perhaps using more natural gas, which has half the CO2 intensity of coal, into the feed, all the way to potentially looking at conversion to natural gas as an option. Having said that, though, the coal is there, and it's a very clean coal that we burn at Genesee. It's very low in elements of environmental concern, like sulfur and mercury. Yes, it does have more carbon because it's coal, but we think we can do things to mitigate that.
Well, you anticipated my question, because not all coal is the same, is it? And there's a real difference between Alberta coal and, say, coal in other places of the world.
Very much so. Alberta coal is known for its extremely low sulfur content, averaging about 0.2%. That's in comparison to some of the coals that perhaps that are burned in the United States and the northeast part of the country, where there's predominantly a lot of coal-fired generation. Sulfur contents in those coals can range up to 5%. So that's a significant difference.
What accounts for that? Like, when coal was formed, Why is it so different?
That's more of a geological question, and I do have some geology background being a mining engineer. Essentially, the bottom line is that over the millennia, over the millions of years that the Earth has been here, there's been numerous ice ages and climate change and all that that's gone on. And in various jurisdictions, like here in Alberta, this place that we're sitting in right now used to be an inland sea. And the sulfur that got into the coal came from the atmosphere at the time in this area. It got into the plants. And for whatever reason, the sulfur in this area was lower than in other areas. And so when that coal compressed and morphized into coal over many, many millions of years, the sulfur content was just lower.
So the sulfur that you do have, how do you deal with that?
Well, we deal with it proactively. So with our Genesee units 1 and 2, those units were built prior to sort of any requirement for sulfur, and they've been grandfathered with the emissions of sulfur that they produce. But with Genesee 3, we took an additional step, and with that unit, we've put on back-end equipment, which I'll call a scrubber, which injects a certain product into the material that comes out of the plant, and that reacts with the sulfur to pull it out of the emissions that would come out. So it really reduces the sulfur content significantly.
And then what happens? Can you market that sulfur?
We're in fact trying to market that, because the sulfur is then captured into the fly ash, and we're looking at ways to market and sell and provide more value to the Genesee 3 fly ash as well. So we are looking at ways to do that. It's not simple, but we're getting close.
What is Genesee 3?
Genesee 3 is the third unit that we built at Genesee. It was commissioned in 2005, and that unit is a supercritical unit versus a subcritical unit with a whole bunch of back-end pollution abatement equipment. So it was the advancement of the technology from Genesee Unit 1 and 2, which was built in the 80s and 90s. It was the latest advancement of that technology to get coal cleaner, more efficient, and remove more emissions.
Now, you do have a mine extension project. What's involved there?
Oh, that's a major regulatory undertaking in which we have to go through various levels of government, federal, provincial, and county, to show them that we need an additional area to provide fuel to the units and that we're going to be doing so in an environmentally conscious way. So everything that we do has to be shown to be environmentally sustainable, and we have to prove to them through these various applications that we can do it. So that's a whole environmental impact assessment process.
So with this mine extension project then, you have to meet regulations in terms of how you're going to deal with sustainability. But does this also involve land, like acquisition of land?
Oh, most definitely. Just to put it into perspective, our current mine permit area was approximately 18,000 acres, and our mine permit extension added an additional 10,000 acres to that, so quite a big percentage. Unfortunately, we don't own all of that land, and it's owned by typically farmers and ranchers that live in the area. So in that process, we had to come up with some fairly innovative ways to, let's say, convince the landowners that they should be purchased. And so we did quite a bit of research on that, and we determined that the best way to do that would be to offer them a premium on top of what the deemed market value was of their property. And we came up with a percentage, and it seemed to work. I say that because we had approximately 60 or so landowners that we approached, and every one of them we were successful through friendly negotiation in acquiring their land. And our alternative was always that we could, if we couldn't acquire the land, we could take them to something called the Surface Rights Board, a board that would hear the landowner's concerns and our concerns and then render a decision. And it was kind of funny because when I budgeted to do this project, I thought to myself, we'll probably have to do two Surface Rights Boards acquisitions a year. And over the course of the 4 to 5 years that we were looking at purchasing the land, we didn't have to do one. So that was good news.
So you've had good success with being able to acquire the land, but are you going to have to dig up all that land all at once? And if not, then how does that work for the farmers?
No, again, it speaks to the 50-year life of the units. So how we sort of handled the acquisitions was that we said to ourselves, who is the best steward of the land, of this farmland? And it's perhaps not even capital power, but the farmer's got pride and history on this piece of land. So what we did is we, in most cases, we offered the farmer the right to lease the land back for X number of years at a very nominal rate. And that kind of helped them out, as well as, from our perspective, was great as well, because they were the stewards of the land and they're not going to destroy anything.
So until such time as you need it, that land can still be used for grazing or putting in crops, that sort of thing?
Yes, absolutely. And all the land that we've acquired in our land database, some of the 18,000 acres I spoke to, that's all under our land stewardship program headed up by George Greenoff, in which he not only does he produce crops, but he puts some of the land out for ranching and cattle grazing. And so it's all productive.
You mentioned fly ash previously. What do you do with fly ash? I guess, first of all, what I should ask you is, what is fly ash?
Well, fly ash is a very light material that comes out of the combustion process for coal. Coal, when it comes out of the ground, has inherently lots of different clays in it. And it's those clays that don't burn that produce the fly ash. And it's a very light material that comes out of the top of the boiler and is collected in either a electrostatic precipitator or a baghouse. The other thing that we produce from these clays is something called bottom ash. And when the coal is burnt, some of this material, like kind of pyrites and heavy rocks, they're not light, so they don't float to the top of the boiler. They fall into the bottom of the boiler and then are removed through a quenching process. So we produce a fly ash and a bottom ash. The fly ash that we produce at Genesee is, I want to say it's almost North American renowned, because we do sell it throughout North America for its quality. It's an extremely high quality Class F fly ash that has a lot of use in the concrete industry, particularly as a replacement for Portland cement in concrete. And the characteristics of our ash are such that it produces a concrete that is stronger, but more importantly, more durable than using normal Portland cement and concrete. So a lot of folks want it that have specialized engineering projects that they are working on. For example, it was used in the Seattle SeaTec runway, the new runway at the Seattle airport. They used our fly ash to construct that runway. It was also used in the construction of the Encana Tower in Calgary. The predominant concrete there has our fly ash mixed into it. So it's got all sorts of unique characteristics that make it extremely valuable.
So why is that?
Well, it goes back to the Roman days, actually, who the Romans were the first to discover that by mixing limestone with volcanic ash, the concrete that you produce is far superior to any other concrete that they ever made before. And you can see that in some of the Roman monuments that still exist today, like the Pantheon in Rome, which looks like it was built yesterday. And so it's essentially the chemistry of it is that fly ash is what's known as a apolazan. And a apolazan reacts in a certain way with Portland cement in concrete to increase the reaction and fill in the voids that Portland cement normally leaves. This fly ash actually creates a chemistry that fills those voids in. A big problem they have in the States is something called alkali silica reactivity. So a lot of the gravels they use there, if they don't use our fly ash in the concrete will crack and spall over a number of years. But our fly ash renders that alkali silica reactivity neutral and increases the durability.
So instead of having a waste product, you actually have a very valuable product that you can sell.
Absolutely, and we produce quite a bit of it. And from Genesee 1 and 2, which doesn't have the back-end pollution equipment on it, basically all of that material is used every year that we produce. From Genesee 3, we're working, as I said earlier, on finding markets for that. It's a little bit different fly ash because of the sulfur removal that we do that gets into the ash. And so we're trying to find ways to mitigate that issue.
Now, you also mentioned bottom ash. So what do you do with your bottom ash?
Bottom ash, again, has some value in industry. For example, we've sold some of it in the construction of the Anthony Henday Freeway as a sub-base material. So that's a material that goes below the concrete and the asphalt that was used in the construction of that freeway. And interestingly enough, it's a material that's very lightweight, and it drains itself very quickly. So it's been used in a number of the sports fields that have been built in the Edmonton area. And the value of that is that when it rains, if you've got our bottom ash as a sub-base on your sport field, it drains very quickly. And so you can get the kids back on there playing soccer.
Now, does this have any impact on your emissions or any of the regulations dealing with climate change and how you're going to do abatement?
Well, the beauty of using fly ash or bottom ash, particularly fly ash I'll speak to in concrete, is that every ton of fly ash that you use as a replacement for Portland cement and concrete saves about one ton of CO2 that would otherwise go into the atmosphere in the manufacturing of that cement. So it's really a greenhouse gas positive product that we produce that helps reduce the overall amount of greenhouse gases that are produced in the province or in the country.
So these are things that you're doing now. What's down the road? What kinds of things are you looking at in terms of climate change policies, new regulations, and innovation on your part?
Well, from my end of things, looking at ways to enhance even in a greater way what we do with the fly ash. There's also some particles in the fly ash that have immense value, and they're called senospheres. We're looking at ways to extract the senospheres, and they're used in very high-end technology sort of manufacturing processes, and they have a great value to industry. Also, even rare earth elements, which are in very, very short supply everywhere in the world except for China, and they're used in everything that we use in our daily lives, like your microphone that you've got in front of my face right now, and all the phones and everything that we use and the TVs. All require rare earth elements. Well, we think that there's some of those in the fly ash that we could probably extract as well. Again, I mentioned earlier that from the combustion end of things, looking at substituting coal with biomass or maybe a little bit more natural gas in the mix or even all the way to conversion to 100% natural gas. It doesn't solve the greenhouse gas issue completely, but it certainly does help reduce it.
Are there any other coal technologies that are coming along?
Oh, yes, most definitely. The whole world is aware of the fact that coal as a fuel produces more CO2 than other corresponding fuels like oil or natural gas that are carbon-based. And so there's a lot of research going on right now in terms of ways to make coal burn a little cleaner. As an example, Capital Power a number of years ago funded a fairly large engineering study to look at integrated gasification combined cycle, which is a technology that essentially converted the coal into a synthetic gas and then burned the gas in a gas turbine, very similar to what we do at Clover Bar or what we're proposing on Genesee 4 and 5. And by doing so, you're able to extract some of the CO2 before the gas is combusted. So that technology looked very promising, but also very, very costly. We're a small company, and it's a technology that ultimately we felt was better for a future point in time when it's been better understood. Some of the new technologies that are coming up are very similar to what we did with Genesee 3, but at Genesee 3 we use supercritical pressures in the boiler. Now they're coming out with ultra supercritical pressures in the boiler, and so some of the efficiencies that they're getting out of these coal-fired power plants are far exceeding even what we've got at Genesee 3. And then I guess I'll conclude with the very interesting design and retrofit that was done at SAS Power's station down in southern Saskatchewan, where they converted it to a CO2 recycle type of plant, and they're able to capture close to 90%, I believe, of the CO2 that's produced from that coal plant. So that's very innovative, and that's kind of the future of coal, I think.
Is there any possibility of integrating things like solar or wind power along with the coal production power?
Well, as you know, Capital Power is a big promoter of wind power. In fact, I would say most of the generation that we've looked at and built in the last few years has been wind power generation. And you ask if there's any opportunity for wind power at a site like Genesee, and perhaps there is, because what I mentioned to you earlier was that we've acquired a large land base with all the surface rights that we've had to acquire, close to 30,000 acres. And maybe that would be a really logical place to put some windmills in the future and just kind of help supplement the coal combustion that we're doing. In terms of solar, we promote that in a big way as well. I don't think at Genesee, though, that there's a huge opportunity, although, again, we have the large land base, and in some cases you do need that when you put these solar panels in place and produce generation from them. So, yeah, I guess in a way we could use our land base for that as well. Our land base in the County of Leduc is probably one of the largest land bases compared to any other city or airport or anything in the county. We're a huge landowner there.
Thank you very much, Darren.
You're welcome.